Welcome to the U.S. Law Essentials Law and Language Podcast, the legal English podcast for non-native English speakers that helps you improve your English listening, improve your legal English vocabulary, and build your knowledge of American legal culture.
Welcome to U.S. Law Essentials Law and Language Podcast. I'm your host, Stephen Horowitz. Today's episode continues our series of interviews with multilingual lawyers. Today's guest is Lucas Resende, an immigration lawyer based in New York and the founder of Resende Law PC. He's originally from Brazil, born and raised in Belo Horizonte, and graduated with a Bachelor in Laws from the Federal University of Minas Gerais and got a Master's of Law, an LLM, from St. John's Law School in Queens, New York, where I used to work. Hi, Lucas, and welcome.
Hi, Steve. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, it's good to have you here. Now, before we get into
good to be here.
I was going to see, since we were both at St. John's together in the past, there's a couple interesting things about St. John's that I think people don't necessarily know. It's way out in Queens, but Queens is cool now. One of the interesting things about St. John's is it's across the street from a neighborhood called Jamaica Estates. Do you know Jamaica Estates at all?
I lived there when I was working at St. John's. I was renting an apartment there.
If you had lived there about 60 years ago, 60 some years ago, one of your neighbors might have been Donald Trump. Did you know that?
Yes.
He grew up in that neighborhood right across the street from St. John's University. One other interesting thing is, have you ever heard of the rap band Run DMC?
Yes, recently.
Run DMC was the first rap band to really go mainstream in the U.S. And they grew up right in Hollis, Queens, which is right by St. John's University. And when I first started working at St. John's, I kept thinking of the line from their song Sucka MCs. In the middle of the song at one point, they go, I'm DMC and the place to be, I go to St. John's University. And since kindergarten, I acquired the knowledge. And after 12th grade, I went straight to college. And I always love that line. And I knew that from the time I was a kid. So I was excited when I finally got to be working at St. John's and I could sing it every day. But then it turned out nobody else I worked with knew that line.
Yeah, there are many interesting facts there. I think they call Queens the world's borough, right? They say people speak more than 100 languages as a first language in the borough of Queens because there's so many immigrants from everywhere.
Yeah, and there is some research done. It's the most linguistically diverse. It's the most linguistically diverse place in the world, in the whole world.
Yeah.
Queens is a pretty amazing place.
And also about Jamaica State, I used to leave my apartment at 8:50 and I will be in the office at St. John's at 9 a.m.
So you lived close.
That's how close it was.
Well, we'll put some links in the show notes to Run DMC, Sucka MCs, and to maybe some links for St. John's as well, so people can take a look. So let's see. The first question I want to ask you is, this might sound kind of funny to you, but have you ever lived in another country, Lucas?
Another country is relative, right? Because the United States for me is another country. I was born and raised in Brazil. And the first time I came to the U.S. as a tourist was 1997. Uh-huh. So I was 13 years old as a kid to visit family. And then later I immigrated to reunite with my family.
And then, so have you ever lived in countries other than the United States or Brazil?
Not lived, but I spent a total of 4 months in Italy.
Oh, wow. What part?
In Rome, doing the study abroad program for St. John's.
And how's your Italian?
Actually, I don't speak Italian. but it turns out St. John's has a campus in Rome, and the staff there is fluent in Italian. Americans who work there, they're fluent in Italian. So it wasn't an issue to handle what I needed to do there. And everything related to the university was conducted in English. And I also speak Spanish and Portuguese, so it's close enough that I could communicate in Italian.
Oh, that must have felt good. So you speak, clearly you speak English.
Yes.
I think that's what we're talking in right now. You speak Portuguese because you're from Brazil, and you speak Spanish also?
Yes, I learned Spanish after I moved to the United States. So I started studying English in elementary school in Brazil, very early, and kept studying my whole life. I did, you know, ESL courses all the way to the end, and I always, maybe one interesting fact about language and about my age, right? I'm a millennial. The first book I read in English was Harry Potter. And that really helped. So I read like the 7 of them. It was a thing at the time. It's a lot of reading. So that was helpful. And then I started with Spanish around 2012. Maybe about 10 years ago, I started studying Spanish because I was already living here in the U.S.
Oh, so as an adult, you didn't learn it growing up in Brazil?
No. Mm-hmm. I learned Spanish in the United States. This is America. I speak Spanish.
Right. And do you speak any other languages? Are there any other languages you can communicate in at all?
Yes. I'm learning Russian. I've been studying for 4 years. So, see, it's a long-term commitment. Like, English since elementary, like, Portuguese since I was born. Like, English since elementary school. Spanish for about 10 years and Russian for about 4 years. Because my wife is Russian.
And do you speak to each other in Russian or in English or in Portuguese?
We speak in English because that's how we communicated since we started dating. Her mother, right? My mother-in-law doesn't speak very limited English. So we communicate. I learn Russian because I want my daughter. I have a daughter. I want her to learn Russian as well. And I want to be able to communicate with her in Russian and with my mother-in-law, and I also have my brother-in-law, and you know, my wife's relatives, they speak limited English. So we can communicate with my basic Russian and sometimes their basic English. So yeah, it's for family reasons. I'm learning Russian.
What's your study method for Russian?
I started with Duolingo.
Duolingo?
Oh, yeah.
My children have been using that. They just play around with it and they pick random languages like German and they learn a little bit of that.
Yeah, I'll say, I think one thing that I would advise, you know, people in general is to focus, right? I think even in Duolingo, you see, oh, they have like 30 languages. Then you start like some 20 of them and you never finish.
Yeah.
I was starting only one. Yeah. And I went all the way to the end. So I did every single exercise. It took me 4 years, but I finish it because, you know, it's hard. It's a lot of content.
So just Duolingo? Any other?
No, after that, because it just gives you the basics. It's good to learn the Cyrillic alphabet, but it's not enough. It's a first step. So my second step is children's books.
That's what I always talk about. I always try to tell my law students to study children's books.
And children's songs, they are so catchy. That was something like I may embarrass myself here singing children's songs, but they're so catchy. They like stick to your head, you know.
Exactly. And that's why they're so great.
Yeah, and I have a 1-year-old daughter. Her birthday is next week, so now she's babbling, starting to talk, and you sing her songs, and she start to repeat some things, and. I'm reading children's books. So the Three Little Pigs, I can go through it. Like for me, it's like painful, you know, but I read through it slowly, but that's how you start. And this basic vocabulary.
Painful because the story is painful and you feel bad for the wolf, or painful because it's hard to read the Russian. You're not used to reading it quickly and it's kind of hard to work through for yourself.
It's hard. And because it's another alphabet. So I'm, you know, used to the Latin alphabet and English, Portuguese, and Spanish. And to have to, you know, read with another alphabet, that's painful. But it takes practice.
That's great practice. It must be really good.
Yeah. And it's better to start with something simple like Three Little Pigs than to try to read, you know, Alexander Pushkin or something more complicated.
Could you read a contract to me in Russian?
No, not at all.
You could do that. That would probably help me fall asleep, I would think.
It's kind of the sound of it, you know, I don't think it's the type of sound that makes you go to, maybe a romance language, right, will make you go to sleep, like more pleasant. Like Russian can be more strong sometimes. Я говорю по-русски, you know, like it's hard to go to sleep with that. But a contrast, I think contrast can make people go to sleep, right? No matter what language they're written in.
But Portuguese has a more relaxing feel to it, right?
Sim, português mais calmo. Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about your work a little bit. So
yes.
Now I like to ask lawyers, how do you explain to non-lawyers what you do? But that's often because a lot of the work that lawyers do is kind of hard to explain to regular people or to like your children or something. But immigration law sounds pretty straightforward. You help people who need to deal with immigration issues. So what do you tell people about your work?
Yeah, I guess it's one way to explain it and make it simple is to talk about the results, right? The result that people want in immigration law, it's a visa, a green card, or U.S. citizenship. Mm-hmm. So I don't know, people may not know, but a green card, it's a popular name for a document called a legal permanent resident card that allows people to immigrate. So that's you know, the green card is a document that shows the status of a legal immigrant. So either the person is a visitor with a visa, is coming here temporarily, it's an immigrant with a green card, or it is a citizen. And that's what I'm doing. I'm representing people in the process of obtaining visas, green cards, and U.S. citizenship.
Is there sort of a common pattern to the kinds of clients that you tend to work with? Are they working with companies? Are they marrying? Are they getting married? Or is it a whole wide range of different situations?
It's a whole wide range of different situations. And that's what I love about it, because people, I listen to people's life stories, right? From so many different backgrounds. There are basically four ways that people immigrate. And that's not from me. That's, you know, John Oliver.
Yeah, John Oliver.
John Oliver, comedian.
Sort of comedian TV show guy. Yeah.
Yeah. So in one of his episodes, he talks about immigration law, and I think he explains it very well. Of course, I believe he had very good immigration lawyers like reviewing it, but he explains it in a fun way, in a very simple way, what a U.S. immigration law is.
Sorry, I was going to say he's from the UK, so he had to deal with immigration. He's had to deal with immigration himself.
Yes, because he came with a work visa and then a green card through work. And he puts it like this. The ways to immigrate, it's good luck, bad luck, family, and work. So good luck is the visa lottery or the green card lottery. So some countries have that. So you're just lucky because you were selected in the lottery. Bad luck, it's asylum or immigration for humanitarian purposes, because you're being persecuted. Basically, you're in a bad situation in your home country and you're asking for humanitarian help. Uh-huh. That's bad luck. And family, you know, obvious. You have relatives in the United States. And work, right? So it's very different. Like when you hear a story about asylum, it's a very sad story. Uh-huh. And when you hear a story about a marriage, for example, you have a fiancé visa, right? And you have to tell that love story in a statement to submit it with your application. Uh-huh. And I like to listen to the stories, and I'm writing that love story to put together with the application. So look how different it is. You're either writing a tragedy, like when you're preparing an asylum application, you have to put that story together, and it can be very painful for people to tell that story. Uh-huh. Or you're writing a love story, right? Or it's about work, you know, and people are pursuing a professional dream, or it's just luck because they got in the lottery. So it's very different.
That's really interesting. I mean, there's so a lot of storytelling, and that's a theme that I've noticed has grown bigger in the legal field is I know in law schools, there's a whole, there's a conference every year on legal storytelling. And because that's recognized now as such an important part of being a lawyer. It's not just analyzing the law, it's telling stories.
Yeah, imagine how much it is to expand an acorn, like I've been persecuted, to like an oak, right? And you have to make that little seed grow and tell the story in a way that shows all the drama and sometimes physical, mental, psychological violence that was involved. So you really have to expand on the who, what, when, how, and why, and tell the story.
Do you have a favorite story that you like to that you can talk about and that you like to share?
Well, there are issues of confidentiality, right? So I'll talk about those. I'm concerned about, you know, telling something that, you know, might reveal somebody's identity. Another type of story, just to give an example, is about extraordinary ability. So that's the green card path, because you come to work in the United States with a certain type of visa. It's an O visa because you have extraordinary ability in an area. So one story that it's public. We're talking about Donald Trump in Queens. His wife Melania obtained a work visa for having extraordinary ability as a model.
Uh huh.
So
say more. Is there more?
that's a story, right? A public figure. So it could be a writer. It could be a chess player. It could be a cook. So imagine somebody that has an extraordinary ability in something. An artist, it's sometimes called an artist visa, but it can be for athletes, for many things.
I just talked with I interviewed an immigration paralegal recently named Rebecca Chen, and she mentioned, I think she mentioned the O visa and called it, she said sometimes it's called an Einstein visa.
Correct.
Have you heard that before?
Yes, I've heard that. So, but as I said, for science, right, if somebody won a Nobel Prize, of course, they were qualified, but it doesn't need to be that high. So calling an Einstein visa, sometimes it gives the impression that the standard, it's only that level. But it's not only Einstein level, you know. Melania Trump as a model, or it could be an athlete, you know, as I said, it could be many different, a photographer, for example. Uh-huh. Maybe I can, you know, just say like a type of work that people did the marketing campaigns, you know, as a photographer for companies like Nike, for example.
Right, very specialized.
So, yeah, professional photographer that would do that type of professional photography for marketing campaigns was considered a person of extraordinary ability.
Now, when... scratch that, Dan. So what does an average day of work look like for you? What kinds of things are you doing during the day, or how are you spending your time?
Today, I think has been like one except for this podcast, right? That is very unusual. Let's say I started with a consultation at 9 in the morning. I did a video consultation. And a person had questions about possibilities. The person, it's a foreign student here in the United States and is doing a program called OPT. It stands for Optional Practical Training. That's basically an internship. And she wanted to talk about possibilities for work visas. And so, yeah, I had a consultation. So I started my day with that in the morning. Then I was replying to emails about also a work visa, but that way it's a person who is already in the, not a visa, green card. It's a person who is, the company is applying for a green card. So we needed a lot of information to prepare those. So information about the company, the size of the company, number of employees, and details about the position. So I exchanged a few emails asking what I needed, and then they just replied. I'm going to get back to that as soon as I finish here. So yeah, sometimes a call with a video, an email. So that would be a normal day. And then before you realize it, he's gone. Preparing documents.
Lucas, let me ask you another question. Several years ago, under the Trump administration, there was an executive order issued that was known as the Muslim ban. Do you remember that?
Yes, I do.
What do you remember about that time from an immigration law perspective?
Yes. So there were many people who were affected by that executive order. I did not work directly with a person who was affected by that executive order. But there was litigation about it. The order was suspended by federal judges at the time. And I'm familiar with it because I read it and, you know, I studied, and it was awful. Like, it should have been suspended because the language there in that executive order was probably not written by an attorney, because it was used more in a journalistic way than in a technical way.
Oh, interesting. Like what?
Legal terms that have a specific meaning and a definition in the Immigration Nationality Act, for example, entry and admission, were used in a way that is not consistent with a definition in the Immigration and Nationality Act. So probably it was not reviewed by the Department of Justice before it was issued, the executive order. They probably, I don't know, maybe Steve Bannon just wrote it and then Trump signed it. It was awful. So that's why it was suspended. And later there was a second and a third version of it. They improved it a little bit, but that I believe was February or January of 2017. That first version was awful. Oh. And yeah, of course it was all like blocked by the courts.
And let me ask you another question about immigration law, which is, if somebody wants to be an immigration lawyer, what would you recommend to them as steps to get into the field?
Focus. And I think
theme.
My theme. I think with technology today, right? You go online, you open your browser, and you're researching something on the internet. It's so easy to get distracted. You get your phone, you have so many apps, and I think our brain is getting wired to lose focus.
Yeah.
And we start a lot of things and we don't finish anything. So I think it's not specific to immigration, but to the law practice in general. It's better to focus on one practice. We have an expression in Portuguese. I'm going to say it in English, but it's like the duck, right? He walks, he flies, and he swims, but he walks poorly, he flies poorly, and he swims poorly. So you don't want to be like a duck that does like everything, but you don't do anything correctly. So it's better to do one thing and do it like correctly, or do it the best way possible, than to try to do everything.
You know the English language equivalent of that phrase, of that expression?
No.
Or maybe you've heard it. Jack of all trades, master of none.
Oh, yes, I've heard that. Yes, jack of all trades, master of none. I think you don't want to be that as an attorney. So I believe there are some great general practitioners out there, but and maybe judges need to have more of that encyclopedical knowledge, right? Uh-huh. But I think it's just better to focus on one thing. And in my practice, I think it's already very broad, as I said, doing humanitarian immigration, business immigration, family-based immigration. Some attorneys, immigration attorneys, focus on only one path to immigration. I do three, and also worked on issues with the lottery as well. And it's already broad. So I see many people trying to be everywhere, and it's so much information to, you know, keep up with. So you're going to miss something if you try to do many different areas. So I wouldn't do, if somebody has an issue with criminal law, for example, and then say, well, will this affect me in my immigration case, yes, I can talk about it, but I wouldn't go to criminal court to represent a person in criminal court because it's very specific, and it's better. I would recommend that person hires a criminal attorney that does only that, because you know we'll be better, best position to, you know, more familiar with the court practice to do something like representing the person in criminal court, for example.
Now let me ask you about language again. How much, I assume since you're based in New York, most of your work you're doing is in English, but how much do you use your Portuguese and your Spanish and even some Russian in your work? Do you have occasion to use it?
Yes. The consultation I did this morning was all in Portuguese because it was with a Brazilian client. That client speaks English fluently, but it's just awkward to speak in English with a person, you know, who speaks your native language.
Sure.
And I guess the person feels more comfortable with it. There is a big, maybe the biggest community in the US, right? That's not English speaking, is the Spanish speaking community, and also in New York. So I have clients who are Spanish speaking and they don't speak very good English. So I communicate with them in Spanish. Depends, you know, maybe once a week, sometimes more often, depends. And Russian less, because my Russian, it's not good enough to have a conversation at a professional level. I'm still working on it. I can say the basic, and I have spoken with Russian speaking clients, but I spoke in English.
Do you have any advice on how to find or how to pick an immigration lawyer? What to look for?
Referrals. Because even if you ask me about other immigration lawyers that I know personally, or lawyers in general, right? It's hard for me to know the quality of their work. So if you have a referral from a former client, I think that's the best way. And that's how most people get to meet, because somebody who I represented, then they talk and the immigrants, and then they, if they hear somebody who needs immigration law, they say, "Oh, talk to Lucas. Like, he worked in my case." And, you know, then they can talk about my work and maybe, you know, how I answer their questions and, you know, follow up. But yeah, it's hard to know, you know, how people work, you know, unless you have knowledge of their work. So, like, if you find someone online, sometimes people find me in Google, but they could find anybody else in Google. So I think I do a good job, but I don't know about others.
Sometimes you see ads on the subway or on billboards on the highway or on TV for lawyers. Do you think you'll ever have a TV ad?
No. I never spent a dime in marketing. Because I mean, I can put my name out there. I think it helps. But well, just because somebody's name is on the outdoor or on TV, you don't know how their work is. So I guess many people would put like results, right, in an outdoor. Sometimes you see personal injury lawyers like, "Oh, got me $1 million," and then you have a kind of a testimony of a former client saying, "Oh, this attorney got me that much money." So at least you have, you know, somebody who was a former client talking about it.
Yeah.
So, but I, you know, people could be like in ads everywhere, but I don't know if they're good or not.
Right. Okay. Well, it has been so great having you on here, Lucas. I really appreciate you taking some time out of your day to come and talk on the podcast with me and with our listeners.
Thank you very much for having me. It was great.
Okay. So, thanks everybody for joining us on this edition of US Law Essentials Law and Language Podcast, and stay essential.